Well, good morning. We'll start with a coded signal that some of you will understand and others not. We start each day by saying, click the mouse. That allows someone somewhere to know that we're starting and that they should record this session. I think that's what is happening. I can't see it either. My name is Fred Niedner from Valparaiso, Indiana, where I teach biblical studies in a department of theology at Valparaiso University. And I'm up here for 2 weeks doing Bible study on the theme that you may have seen up on the kiosk, cracked pots overflowing with the mercy or the treasure of God's mercy and reconciliation. The theme comes from the theme verse for this summer. We have this treasure, the rest of which is in earthen vessels or in clay jars, depending upon the translation you're using. My version of it, cracked pots, I took from Dan Erlander's theme t-shirt, which I have a version of here this morning. You cannot buy one precisely like this in the bookstore. This one is unique. You can buy yellow, which does not go with my skin tone. You can buy brown, which does not go with my skin tone. Or you can buy white. So I bought a white one and had my daughter, who's working in the craft area these last days, make this for me. So
there you go.
A society of cracked pots. We are at Holden, and I started talking about cracked pots full of God's reconciliation because of the way I understand what Paul is saying in the theme verse and in the part of 2 Corinthians that the theme verse comes from. I'll just read that verse and a couple of things surrounding it. If you want to follow along, it's in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, beginning with the material that's on the beautiful banners in the village center. We have this treasure in clay jars, so that it may be made clear that this extraordinary power belongs to God and does not come from us. We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed, perplexed, but not driven to despair, persecuted, but not forsaken, struck down, but not destroyed, and I would add cracked, but not worthless. Always carrying in the body the death of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may also be made visible in our bodies. So we are ordinary clay jars, making visible to the world Jesus Christ, and in our own bodies the work of Jesus Christ, or what Paul calls at the end of this section, at the end of 2 Corinthians 5, the righteousness of God in action. That's what we get to be as the clay vessels, the earthen vessels, baptized into this community of cracked pots. So I've been doing a whole sequence of cracked pots over last week, and now we'll do this week some different ones. I started with Paul himself, and he owns up to being a cracked pot. Then I went back to the original cracked pot vessel through which God tried to work reconciliation in the world, and still does, the people of Israel. And then the carriers of Israel's blessing in the first generations as signs of God's reconciling work. The first one being Isaac, sign of God's and our laughter together. Jacob, who became Israel, the one who wrestles with God, and Judah, the one whose name means, O give thanks, and is a sign of thankfulness and a certain kind of surrender in this world. Then I moved to Jeremiah, which took a couple of days, and that brings us to today. We will be looking at Ezekiel, who I have titled a certifiably cracked prophet of hope. I'm also honoring a personal tradition in these days that I'm doing this. I used to explain this in detail, how I learned from Elmer Witt years and years and years ago, that at Holden you must always honor, along with the mission statement and now the village's core values, hilarity. And I was always worried that I couldn't make hilarity happen naturally in my sessions. So I would try to force some at the beginning, so that at least there was a legitimate attempt. And so I'm sharing hopeful hilarity. Usually I try to make it go with the day, the day's theme, but you know, the prophets were not funny guys. So I've had to borrow things from odd places. The prophets were anguished guys, as we'll see, so I brought along an old favorite collection of silly things called Anguished English, which is a collection of botched uses of the English language brought into a collection by Richard Lederer. This is just kind of arbitrarily picked, except I think sometimes that when you ran into a prophet, you didn't quite know what had happened to you. You felt like maybe you'd been in an accident. So I brought along today a few samples of things supposedly written for accident reports submitted to insurance companies, in which you are supposed to describe what happened in the fewest words possible. And that combination of human beings' tendency to try to make themselves look in the right in an accident situation, plus using the fewest words possible, comes out to some interesting results sometimes. Coming home, I drove into the wrong house and collided with a tree I didn't have. In an attempt to kill a fly, I drove into a telephone pole. This is in the era before cell phones. So we could really do some... I had been learning to drive with power steering. I turned the wheel to what I thought was enough and found myself in a different direction, going the opposite way. An invisible car came out of nowhere, struck my car, and vanished. The indirect cause of the accident was a little guy in a small car with a big mouth. Early road rage. The telephone pole was approaching fast. I was attempting to swerve out of its way when I struck my front end. As I approached the intersection, a stop sign suddenly appeared where no stop sign had ever appeared before. I was unable to stop in time to avoid the accident. I pulled away from the side of the road, glanced at my mother-in-law, and headed over the embankment. A lot of the rest of them are about hitting pedestrians, but I don't want to think about that. We never do that up here at Holden. So today Ezekiel is our cracked pot. Before I get to talking about Ezekiel in a specific way, some background. Ezekiel, just a bit of his personal history and where it fits in. Ezekiel was from the priestly families of ancient Israel. We talked a little bit last week. Hardly any of you were here last week, so I'll have to bring back at least a few details. Hardly any of the prophets, save for a couple significant ones, were from the priestly families. Prophets and priests didn't always mix that well. If you read prophetic literature, you find frequent denunciations of the cult and of the kinds of things that the priests insisted that the people of Israel be doing. Prophets didn't get along that well with kings either, as we know quite a bit better. But Ezekiel was from the priestly families of Israel, or of Judah. Israel is long gone. The southern kingdom of Judah is all that's left. And Ezekiel, as a priest, was literate, and therefore was among the people that the Babylonians deported from Judah 10 years before the destruction of Jerusalem in 586 or 587 BCE. It's then as an exile from his homeland off in Babylon that Ezekiel prophesies or has his visions and his ministry of prophecy. So to understand Ezekiel, we have to understand the plight of Israel during the time of the exile. Those of you who were here last week spent some time with me thinking about the prophecy of Jeremiah, who prophesied both before and during the beginning stages of exile up into the destruction of Jerusalem. And so we watched the people of Judah slide into oblivion a bit last week from Jeremiah's point of view. The exile at the hands of the Babylonians was a crisis of not only major but multiple proportions. It was obviously just a plain human disaster. The Babylonians, like the Assyrians, had the practice of killing at least a third of the people that they conquered, hauling away another third to different parts of the empire, and leaving the least able to survive in the ruins of what they had conquered. So it's a devastation that we can probably not imagine unless you've been through something similar in some other part of the world. The United States hasn't known anything like this since the Civil War. But it was also a theological crisis of major proportions because of what had happened in the decades just prior to this destruction. To put it somewhat shortly, during the years that the Assyrians controlled the northern territory that neighbored Judah, and the Babylonian Empire was beginning to feel its strength and would eventually conquer the Babylonian Empire, and then they controlled that territory up to the north of Judah. For 55 years during that period, a king named Manasseh had kept Israel, kept Judah in good shape politically, which for a little tiny country like Judah simply meant keeping them intact and viable as a people. But Manasseh did this at the expense of making all kinds of alliances that included bringing in the religion of other tribal groups and other peoples around them, allowed that to be practiced in Jerusalem, because that's the way alliances and treaty making worked in the ancient world. And so you may know that Manasseh is known as the worst of all the kings who ever ruled in Jerusalem, because he allowed all these foreign worship practices. He's also accused of in the Deuteronomistic history, which is Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings, which tells the story of the people's life in the land of Israel. He's accused by that historian of having tried to end the worship of Yahweh, the God of Israel, and of putting to death anyone who insisted on worshiping Yahweh, and especially persecuting all those who thought that the worship of Yahweh should be the religion and faith of Judah. He is also accused of having sacrificed some of his own children in the worship of other gods and so forth. Well, Manasseh dies finally and is succeeded by his son Amon, who lasted just a very short time before he was murdered by some people called the people of the land, who put on the throne a 9-year-old boy named Josiah. And Josiah then is credited by the Deuteronomistic historian with having totally reformed Israel, brought it back to a pristine worship of Yahweh, cleaned up the temple, insisted that there is no worship of any god but Yahweh in the whole land. And for that he earns the accolade in 2 Kings 23 of having been the most faithful king in the history of kings of God's people. No one, either before or after, was ever so faithful as Josiah because of how zealously he reformed the religion of Judah and Jerusalem. During the time that Josiah was cleaning the place up, and by the way, I mentioned he was on the throne when he was 9, you can bet that this reform was not his idea. You know what 9-year-old boys do, and it's not a whole lot of obsessing about the gross domestic product and the relationship of the cult to the political situation. He was doing Facebook somewhere while all these people of the land who had put him in power were running this reform. But one day, in the middle of the temple being all cleaned up, someone rushes to him and says, "We found a book in the temple. You got to see this. It's Moses's words for us today, and no one's ever seen this before. It was lost, but now it's found. Look at this." And it's a book that says, among other things, you can only worship God in one place. Doesn't name the place, but when you read the material, you can see it's pretty strongly clued that it's Jerusalem. No worship of God anywhere else. It also says a few other things that make it easy to identify what it was they found. What they found was a copy of what we now call the middle sections of the book of Deuteronomy, from approximately chapters 5 to 26, 27, 28, somewhere around in there. No one had ever seen this before, and people had been worshiping Yahweh all over the place in the land. Why, there were tons of priests up in Anathoth, where Jeremiah was from, worshiping Yahweh up there, and there had been people all over worshiping Yahweh, but all of a sudden we found a book that says you can only do it in one place. Not only that, but this book says, if you obey these commands and worship God as demanded here, God will save you from all eventualities, protect you from all your enemies. You will be safe if you obey this covenant. If you disobey this covenant, you will be utterly destroyed. And if you want to read a description of what it was like to be destroyed, you want to read some of the later chapters of Deuteronomy, which are really not so much threats as they are actual descriptions of what it was like to live in a siege. What it was like to be in a city that couldn't bring food in for 3 years. If you obey, you're safe. If you don't, you're not. And God will destroy you. Well, they obeyed. Josiah reformed the nation, and they were in compliance with this covenant. But then, of all things, Josiah goes out and has a confrontation with Pharaoh Necho, who kills him. And that's the end not only of Josiah, but Josiah is the last king who was ever on the throne in Jerusalem, who was decided upon either by the royal family or by the people of Judah and Israel themselves. Everyone who ever rules for the next little bit of time that the people of Judah existed under the Davidic dynasty was put on the throne by either the Egyptians or the Babylonians. So Josiah is the end of their autonomy. They had obeyed the covenant, which says, if you obey, you will be saved. And only if you defy this covenant will you be lost, or can you be destroyed. They obeyed, and they got destroyed anyway. Within a short time after Josiah's death, they slid into oblivion. What does this mean? Was this covenant a lie? Or could perhaps it be that God wanted to keep this covenant with us but couldn't? The Babylonians were finally too strong even for God's covenant promises to be kept? Or how exactly do you explain this? That God did not save us when we obeyed? The Deuteronomistic history has its own answer. In 2 Kings 23, where it talks about how great Josiah was, the narrator says, "Nevertheless, despite Josiah's faithfulness, God remained so furious about the sins of Manasseh that God decided to wipe Judah off the face of the earth as God had done with Israel, because God simply couldn't get over the abominations of Manasseh." Now, I don't know if you like that theology, which in effect says you can be as faithful as you want, but if God hated your grandpa, you're done. Because God just doesn't get over some of these things. And, you know, he kind of waited to see how it would go with Josiah, but it was good, but apparently not good enough. I mean, that gives you a clue about the extreme measures to which the theologians of Judah were going in order to try to explain this great debacle. Well, it must have been Manasseh. I mean, what else are we supposed to say? We know from things that appear in other works that some people said, this just proves Yahweh wasn't much of a God anyway. Yahweh can't deal with the gods of Babylon. So we might as well go with the gods of Babylon. I mean, why not? Let's go with a winner. Which is what many ancient peoples did. If your god lost, I mean, you never thought of a war or a battle with other people, except it was also a battle between your gods. So it must mean Marduk whomped up on Yahweh. We might as well go with Marduk. That's another possible solution. Another possible solution is just to chuck it all. We always get the idea that everyone thought alike in the ancient world because we read about, and then all Israel said this, and then all Israel said that. Be very careful of that kind of thinking. There was just as much diversity of thought in the ancient world as there is today, and the Bible is a record of how much diverse thought there was. in so many instances. So there were a lot of different answers at work among the people, but not very many of them led towards the conclusion that you ought to stick with Yahweh, or that you'd even want to stick with Yahweh. And so it was left to a handful of prophets to try to teach somehow a way to understand what had happened to them, along with giving them some hope for a future that would make them want to keep on worshiping Yahweh, the God of Abram and Sarah and the subsequent generations. And among those people is Ezekiel. And Jeremiah had made a start at this because he lived through not only the deportation 10 years before, but he saw the end and he wrote hopeful things, as we saw last week. The most famous of the prophets, probably not so much in people knowing about this prophet, because we don't know about this prophet. This prophet wrote anonymously and attributed his work to someone who lived long before. Whoever wrote Isaiah 40 to 55 is not merely a remarkable prophet, but one of the most remarkable poets of any age, including our own. So these prophets addressed the things that troubled Israel so terribly, that troubled the Jews so terribly after the loss of their city. How could this happen to us was one question. What does this say about God, this disaster? It also raised the question, where is God? Because, you know, the way that Deuteronomy had it wired, God dwelled in the Jerusalem temple, sitting upon the Ark of the Covenant, which is the throne of Yahweh. And if the Babylonians came and destroyed that, razed the temple to the ground, and apparently either stole the Ark or destroyed it. Of course, we know it was stolen until Indiana Jones found it. That's another deal. Where is God? How can we worship God? We have some beautiful but terribly sad poetry, like Psalm 137. How can we possibly sing the Lord's song in this foreign place? There's no point in singing to Yahweh here. We are so far away, Yahweh can't hear us singing in this God-forsaken place. Where is God? Beneath the rubble of the Jerusalem temple, or what? So this is the backdrop for the prophets of the exile. And Ezekiel is a very long book, difficult to read because it's so incredibly redundant, and parts of it are so bizarre and weird, that we're going to take on some of Ezekiel's prophecies today. We're not going to start at the beginning. We're going to start a little after the beginning. I want to show you why I call this man certifiably cracked. This gives us a window on something that I didn't talk about last week, but prophets weren't the most ordinary guys in the world in the first place. If you would turn to Ezekiel chapter 3, verses 22 and following. Then the hand of the Lord was upon me there, and he said to me, "Rise, go out into the valley, and there I will speak with you." So I arose up and went out into the valley, and the glory of the Lord stood there like the glory that I'd seen by the river Kibar. I fell on my face. The Spirit entered into me and set me on my feet and spoke with me and said, "Go shut yourself inside your house. As for you, mortal," and the word, just so you know, in this translation, mortal, the phrase son of man, Ben Adam, is here every time in Hebrew. As for you, mortal cords shall be placed on you, and you shall be bound with them so that you cannot go out among the people. And I will make your tongue cling to the roof of your mouth so that you shall be speechless and unable to reprove them, for they are a rebellious house. And when I speak with you, I will open your mouth, and you shall say to them, thus says the Lord God, let those who will hear, hear, and those who refuse to hear, refuse. They are a rebellious house. So Ezekiel is to sit in his mouth, in his house, tied up, unable to speak. Doesn't say for exactly how long. But, you know, that doesn't sound like a really, really powerful way to get a message out. Unless you have really nosy neighbors who go around talking about this all day, but Ezekiel's in his house, tied up, not talking. But just imagine spending, you know, even a week or a month tied up in your house, not communicating. Well, then what happens next? Chapter 4. Now, mortal, take a brick and set it before you. On it, portray a city, Jerusalem, and put siege works against it, and build a siege wall against it, and cast a ramp up against it. Set camps also against it, plant battering rams against it all around, then take an iron plate and place it as an iron wall between you and the city. Set your face toward it and let it be in a state of siege and press the siege against it. This is a sign for the house of Israel. Then lie on your left side and place the punishment of the house of Israel upon it. You shall bear their punishment for the number of days that you lie there. For I assign to you a number of days, 390 days, equal to the number of years of their punishment, and so you shall bear the punishment of the house of Israel. When you finish that, lie down a second time on your right side and bear the punishment of the house of Judah. 40 days I assign you, one day for each year. You shall set your face toward the siege of Jerusalem, and with your arm bared you shall prophesy against it. See, I am putting cords on you so that you cannot turn from one side to the other until you have completed the days of your siege. Okay, so make a little model of the city of Jerusalem. And, you know, just like we used to play with army guys when I was little, you know, those little green figures, you know, make a siege. Make it look like a city under siege. Put an iron plate next to it and then lie on your side next to that, all tied up. For 390 days, lie in the street like that, next to that little city, as a sign that you are bearing the punishment of Israel. Then, after 390 days, turn over and lie there for 40 more. Can you imagine? Don't even try to imagine yourself doing that. But imagine that going on out here in the road for a year and a half. Some guy lying out there tied up next to his little model of the city. It doesn't say he can't talk this time. But if he can talk, he says it's a sign from God about this people. I mean, you know very well what we would do today, right? At the very least, if we were kind, we would say, Ezekiel, your life does not have to be like this. We have meds that can help you. You can feel better than this. Or if we weren't so kind, we'd scoop the sucker out of the street and at least put him off to the side somewhere. So he's out of our way, for goodness sakes. And this is just pathological behavior. This is a broken man. And I could show you a whole bunch of other things, ways in which he was a broken man, and did things that would have got him, you know, institutionalized. He cut off all his hair and burned part of it, and tied part of it to his belt, and scattered part of it to the wind. he has another moment in which God tells him, Ezekiel, tomorrow morning your wife is going to die, and you are not allowed to mourn, because I want your life to be a sign that what's happened to the people of Israel is so terrible, it is deeper than something you can mourn. And lo and behold, I woke up the next morning, my wife was dead. And so I didn't mourn. I mean, can you imagine the emotional state of this person? Prophets were people who endured a lot of pain. They did strange things, and we are left to wonder about what it means for God to get hold of somebody and use them like this. Isaiah had spent 3 years running around Jerusalem naked and barefoot as a sign against the Philistines, not even against Israel. Micah spent a part of his career back in the 8th century, contemporary of Isaiah, going naked and screeching like an ostrich as a sign against the people. Now, we saw Jeremiah and his craziness, and now Ezekiel. But Ezekiel also provided us some of the most amazing pieces of the theological tradition, not only of Judaism, but also of Christianity. You could do maybe I couldn't, but Susan Briel could teach a whole course up here just on the use of Ezekiel in John and in the book of Revelation. If that writer, if the Johannine writer had not had Ezekiel, it'd be some really different stuff. So, let's sample a few of the things that Ezekiel did. For one thing, I think you can see already in what I've pointed out that Ezekiel has an answer to why this happened to us. All the prophets finally came to agree. We got what we deserved. It was not the fact that Yahweh failed the covenant. We broke the covenant. And we broke the covenant long before the days of Josiah, and we didn't really fix anything in the days of Josiah. Jeremiah had already indicated that with his famous temple sermon that some of us looked at last week together, when Jeremiah stood in the temple and said, "Don't think, people, that because you got the temple of the Lord, you're safe. You can't stand here and say, 'The temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, we're safe.'" Doesn't work, sorry. That's Jeremiah 7 and 26. The prophet said, it wasn't Manasseh. It wasn't Yahweh unable to do anything. We brought this on ourselves. Now, the second Isaiah, Isaiah 40, is going to finally say, you know, the truth is we actually got twice what we deserved. We deserved what we got, but we got it in double measure. Even God agrees to that. But it was our own sins for which we paid. So that's one answer that the prophets agreed upon. They also agreed that there was hope, that there would be a future. And Jeremiah already had prophesied that. But there were some other questions that needed answering. Turn to Ezekiel 1, finally, and we'll look at the beginning of this. And we don't have time to do this in great detail, so this will be a flying trip, a flying visit on a flying machine. There's the superscription to the poem, which is in very great detail, unlike all the, to the book, not the poem. A superscription that's much more detailed than any of the prophetic literature before it has. And then a vision, beginning in verse 4. As I looked, the vision is happening in Babylon, by the way, along the river Kibar. I saw a stormy wind come out of the north, a great cloud with brightness around it, and fire flashing forth continually, and in the middle of the fire something like a gleaming amber. In the middle of it was something like four living creatures. This was their appearance. They were of human form. Each had four faces, and each had four wings. Their legs were straight, and the soles of their feet were like the soles of a calf's foot. They sparkled like burnished bronze. Under their wings, on their four sides, they had human hands, and the four had their faces on their wings thus. Their wings touched one another. Each of them moved straight ahead without turning as they moved. As for the appearance of their faces, the four had the face of a human being, the face of a lion on the right side, the face of an ox on the left, and the face of an eagle. Such were their faces. Their wings were spread out above. Each creature had two wings, each of which touched the other, touched the wing of another, while two covered their bodies. So they were like those flaming things in Isaiah 6 that some of us saw last week. They used part of their wings to cover their private parts. Each moved straight ahead. Wherever the Spirit would go, they went, without turning as they went. In the middle of the living creatures, there was something that looked like burning coals of fire, like torches moving to and fro among the living creatures. The fire was bright, and lightning issued from the fire, and the living creatures darted to and fro like flashes of lightning. And as I looked at the living creatures, I saw a wheel on the earth beside the living creatures, one for each of the four. As for the appearance of the wheels, their construction and appearance was like gleaming beryl, and the four had the same form, like a wheel within a wheel. When they moved in any of the four directions without veering as they moved. Their rims were tall and awesome and were covered with eyes all around. When the living creatures moved, the wheels moved beside them, and when the living creatures rose from the earth, the wheels rose. Wherever the Spirit would go, they went. And the wheels rose along with them, for the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. Okay, I don't know if you can picture this, and I don't have film, I don't have a diagram, but just for the moment, pretend I am one of these, and I am standing on my hook calf's feet, and you can't see my wings, but these will have to suffice. They're standing in formation, making a rectangle, each touching, you know, there's one over here standing like I am, and the four of them stand in formation, and they've got their wheels, each one has wheels by them, and they go straight ahead. None of them ever, you know, okay, they move in formation, up, down, sideways, they can go in any direction thanks to these wheels and whirring wings. Okay? Over their heads, there was something like a dome, shining like crystal spread out above their heads. Under the dome, their wings were stretched out towards one another and so forth. I heard the sound of the wings like the sound of mighty waters and the thunder of the Almighty, a sound of tumult. So this thing has a really powerful engine. Whatever it is, this thing that these creatures are forming. Above the dome over their heads, verse 26, was something like a throne, in appearance like sapphire, and seated above the likeness of a throne was something that seemed like a human form. Upward from what appeared like the loins, I saw something like gleaming amber, something that looked like fire enclosed all around, and downward from what looked like the loins, I saw something that looked like fire, and there was splendor all around, like the bow in the cloud on a rainy day. Such was the appearance of the splendor all around. This was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. And when I saw it, I fell on my face, and I heard the voice of someone speaking. And what follows then is, we're not going to do this today because there's no time, Ezekiel's call narrative. This is the moment he is called to be a prophet in the presence of the vision of this thing. So it's this formation of creatures with a platform above them on which is enthroned. Notice how many levels there are here. The appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. With three layers, three metaphorical layers removed from seeing God, but we see the vision of something that's going on with God. What is this thing? Some of you geezers like me remember that Eric von Daniken wrote a book that suggests this was a space vehicle come from another galaxy to visit Earth in the 6th century. Made a lot of money writing that stuff. But you didn't need to propose something so wild in order to understand what Ezekiel is doing. All you needed to do was to understand the ancient traditions about where Yahweh was and the terrible plight that Israel was in now, not knowing where Yahweh was. Where was Yahweh? Yahweh was enthroned upon the cherubim. And that tradition went way back in 1 Samuel, when Israel gets into a battle with the Philistines and it's not going so well, they say, let's get Yahweh out here to the battle because we're losing and we need Yahweh's help. Quickly send to Shiloh and get the Ark of the Covenant out here on which Yahweh is enthroned. And so they go get the Ark of the Covenant and bring it out, and that starts a really wild story in which God pulls all kinds of tricks on people. But remember what the Ark looks like? The Ark of the Covenant? As one of my students once wrote in an exam, as a box of commandments. But on top of it, does anybody remember what's on top of the Ark of the Covenant?
Cherubim.
Two cherubim. A cherub is a bull or calf figure with wings, and the face, you know, it's got the lower parts of a bull and wings, and the face usually of a human or some other humanoid creature. And there's one on either side of the ark, made of gold, and that's Yahweh's throne. These things are cherub figures, but really souped up ones, with wheels and eyes on the wheels so that it can go in any direction. This thing can go anywhere. This is a Yahweh mobile. Yahweh, the point is, Yahweh, and I'll show you the rest of this in a moment, Yahweh is not trapped in the temple. Look to chapter 10. At the end of some other visions that Ezekiel has had, he's commanded to go and look. Let's start at verse 6. When he commanded the man clothed in linen, take fire from within the wheel work from among the cherubim, and see there, he names them finally. These creatures are called cherubim, which is plural of cherub. He went in and stood behind a wheel, and a cherub stretched out his hand from among the cherubim to the fire that was among the cherubim, took some of it, put it into his hands, and the man clothed in linen who took it went out. The cherubim appeared to have the form of a human hand under their wings. I looked, and there were four wheels beside the cherubim, one beside each cherub, and the appearance of the wheels was like gleaming beryl. And so we get this same description that we had before. And then verse 15, the cherubim rose up. These were the living creatures that I saw by the river Kibar. When the cherubim moved, the wheels moved beside them, and when the cherubim lifted up their wings to rise up from the earth, the wheels at their side did not veer, and so forth and so forth. And then verse 18, the glory of the Lord went out from the threshold of the house, and stopped above the cherubim. The cherubim lifted up their wings, rose up from the earth in my sight as they went out with the wheels beside them. They stopped at the entrance of the east gate of the house of the Lord, and the glory of the God of Israel was above them. These were the living creatures that I saw by the river Kibar. So he's connecting what he sees now to his first vision, and he describes them once again. And then in chapter 11, there's the vision of this thing rising up above the temple in Jerusalem and going east. The Yahweh Mobile has left the building and is last seen headed east. And where's east? Exile. This whole long, complicated thing is a way to say to the people of Israel, Yahweh is not crumpled beneath the ruins of the Jerusalem temple, nor are your hopes, nor is your future lost in that spot. But Yahweh has come up from all that and has come into exile with you. Now there's a couple of important theological developments there. One of them simply is this maybe sounds juvenile and silly to you, but there was not a theology of God's omnipresence at this time. I mean, that's a new idea. God was in Jerusalem. Every God was someplace. Sort of like my wife's grandfather has in Chesterton, Indiana, on his tombstone, it says, everybody's got to be someplace.
Got to be someplace.
His wife's tombstone says, patience. Of which she needed a lot. That was the universal thinking. Just like everybody else, gods were someplace. And, you know, it took some breaking of that old idea for some new idea to emerge. And the new idea that emerges out of Ezekiel's ministry is the fact that God is not tied to a locale. This is still a step removed from God is everywhere. This is God can go everywhere. On the cherubim. On the Yahweh Mobile. Including, and now here's the second development, into exile with us. What a crazy idea that is. God goes into exile with us. So this is hope. We're not lost to God. Can we sing the songs of Zion in this God-forsaken place? Well, we can at least sing what Ezekiel sings, because God comes into exile with us. Okay, we got only 5 minutes, and I haven't let you say a word yet. Any questions or comments about that, at least so far? Yeah.
When we're looking at the chapter 4 thing, it's interesting to me. I read it a little bit differently. He makes this model with this brick and this iron plate, and then he has to lie next to it all tied up. But then in verse 4, we read, then lie on your left side and place the punishment of the house of Israel upon it. So he's got to put this model with the brick and the on his side. You shall bear their punishment for the number of the days that you lie there. So he's actually not just looking at this thing for 390 days. He's got it on himself.
Yeah, okay.
Bearing it.
Yeah.
Which makes it even worse.
Yeah. Yeah, that's another way to see it. I mean, yeah. You gotta lie there balancing this thing on you.
That's a real personal way of bearing the punishment.
Yeah. So, and in particular, bearing the siege and bearing the embattlements and bearing all the terrible things that are being done.
Some of them on you.
Okay, speak, I sort of hear it.
Well, I just, it occurs to me when you tried to describe the cherubim in the book A Swiftly Tilting Planet, Madeline Langell does a pretty good job of explaining what I always thought a cherubim looked like. So if anybody's interested.
Well, there's
all the feathers and all of the eyes and.
Yeah, there's a lot of traditions about cherubim and what they look like. The ones you should, by all means, should look at with a grain of salt are the ones in medieval art, where they're chubby little Anglo-Saxon babies floating around nativity scenes. You know, that. If you want to see some existing examples of ancient cherubim figures, you go to places like the Oriental Institute in Chicago, where there are some that come from Babylon that have been brought over to the United States and put in a museum. And they're massive things. Very, you know, this was something that would have scared people who came upon them in an ancient city, especially if you came in from the country and you never, I mean, it's artwork, two or three of them would fill this space. They're huge. And they are bull-like figures with wings. There are other examples of them. I mean, no one knows exactly what they looked like because we only have sort of minimal descriptions. But they were odd characters that appeared in the religious traditions of many peoples, not just Israel. The Philistines, so far as I know, didn't talk about them, but the Canaanites did. The Canaanite god Baal roamed the earth on a cherub.
Brad, this is some comfort to prisoners of war. I just kept thinking about the Holocaust. Can God be here?
Well, that's the point. No matter where we go, God comes among us. Yeah.
Hope.
Pardon?
You said hope, I think that's.
Yeah. Yeah. You can have hope because God will come into your exile. Now some of you, I'm surprised somebody didn't say, well, what about the tabernacle? Well, that image of God as a tabernacling God in the book of Exodus is God as someone who lives in a tent. That actually comes from the period of the exile. One of Ezekiel's, in my estimation, one of the people who came under the influence of Ezekiel is whoever it is that we call the priestly writer of the Pentateuch, who wrote another version of Israel's ancient story, or fashioned it from the stuff of the Pentateuch, and told the story of the God who tabernacles about the wilderness with us. And that's that's the vision also of the second Isaiah. Isaiah 40 to 55 says, don't ever say, where are we in relationship to God, that God has maybe forgotten about us. We are all in God's tent. God is the one who spread the tent over the whole earth, and we're all in God's tent. The whole earth is in God's tent. And the word is tabernacle. The whole earth is God's sanctuary. Now we're getting to the point of omnipresence. That the whole, you know, that the God of Israel is the God and everywhere. So that's the next step. I'm surprised the bell has not rung. It's about a minute and a half after 10. Maybe one or two more questions?
When you were talking about King Josiah and putting everything straight, was that a version of a Hebraic Taliban?
Well, I guess so, in the sense that every era has its zealots. And I think it's arguable that a zealot is a zealot is a zealot. And there are zealots in every age and zealots in every tradition, and sometimes the zealots take over and they get a certain amount of stuff done, but sooner or later they drive stuff in the ground. And then we all got to recover. And, you know, there was a certain amount of sense in what Josiah did. What the people who had Josiah do. There was some wisdom to that, but they drove it in the ground. You know, the Deuteronomic theology cannot sustain people through what happened finally. It broke. Deuteronomic theology broke. And even the Deuteronomists finally learned that there had to be other ways to look. And so we get this second layer of Deuteronomic thought called Deuteronomistic, which did hold out hope for some of the... I mean, they learned from people like Jeremiah. Well, thank you very much. Tomorrow...